Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and greetings once more from here in Dubai. This is episode number 71 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, we are nearing the end of the production of our latest film about special economic zones and the future of cities, and I'm very happy to report back that it's all going very well. I've certainly learnt an immense amount over the last week or so speaking to all our interviewees. I've also had the chance to record a few podcasts along the way, and today's show is one such recording. It's a conversation I have just had literally half an hour ago with the Free Cities Foundation's very own senior economist, Vera Kitchenova. Obviously, we take a pretty deep dive into private cities. You may not know this, but Vera received the world's first ever PhD in the subject. Something else you may not know about her is that way back in the day, she was Russia's first ever elected libertarian. So I had to ask her about that, of course. Anyway, there's also a sprinkling of Argentinian politics, some observations on the success of the UAE, and we discussed the current buzz around Saudi Arabia and the country's plans for the future that everyone's talking about. All the Free Cities links you could ever need are, as always, in the show notes. And did you know, if you like our content here on the Free Cities Podcast, you can actually now support us with a weekly donation on Patreon. It's patreon.com/, guess what, Free Cities Podcast. That's right. As little or much as you like, every penny will obviously be greatly appreciated as we continue to bring you all the most important voices from the Free Cities ecosystem. But of course, you don't need to do any of that either. You came here to listen to the great Free Cities content, so why not just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Vera Kitchenova. So you are our chief economist at the Free Cities Foundation, right?
Right.
What does that actually mean? What does a chief economist do at the Free Cities Foundation, now firstly?
A chief economist, a senior economist to be precise, at the Free Cities Foundation means that I analyze free cities of the past and the present in a way what works economically and what doesn't when it comes to running them, attracting people, building up, creating infrastructure and so on. And I am trying my best to come up with some patterns and some advice for the future projects of this kind.
So it sounds like you do a lot of what you do is research. And I also understand that you have qualifications in free cities, which is a relatively new thing. Is that right?
That's right. I probably am the first person ever to write a PhD about private cities.
Really? So, okay. My first question is then, what did you do prior to a PhD? What did you study?
I've done a lot of different things. So my first degree was in journalism. It was back in Moscow. Then my second degree, my master's, was in public policy, which I did at Oxford. And then I went on to study political economy in London, and that's what my PhD was.
And what was the exact title of your PhD?
It's called Cities as Firms, the Cozian Case for Private Urban Development.
Cozian case?
Yes.
What does that mean?
So Ronald Coase was a Nobel Prize winner in the 20th century, And he is famous for several things, including the transaction cost theory and also the theory of the firm. So by the time he was writing, coming up with that theory in the 30s, he was already pretty clear that market economy works better than command and control economy in terms of maximizing the society's wealth. And he asked himself, okay, if market economy works best, then why do we have firms, which are essentially these pockets of command and control planning? And his answer was, because we need to minimize transaction costs, because if everyone is acting as individual agents in this ocean of free market, then every time you want to make a deal, sell your service, sell a product, you need to start all over again, looking for suppliers, looking for clients, making sure that your counter agents are honest, and so on and so forth. So it, at some point, it becomes more economical to create these pockets, islands of planning in this ocean of free market, and to minimize transaction costs, to outsource some of this transaction costs to this vertical decision-making procedures. And my idea was that cities can function as firms as well, because a private planner, a private city developer has an incentive to create this to create a system that would be still efficient. And we have a lot of these inefficiencies in traditional cities, you know, the NIMBYs, not in my backyards, people who have no other things to do, so they hijack this democracy procedures and make all development practically impossible because they resist every project, every improvement scheme. And just even if we take the a lot of benevolent actors, even if they, we assume they want the best for the city, still they can get entangled in this negotiations process, public hearings. I know it very well from my experience as an elected official. And the cities just stagnate. They don't move forward. So I analyzed what would it be if a city was run as a firm. And I took some examples of cities which may not be entirely 100% private, but what I called semi-private. They are either built privately but governed in a traditional way, or they were like conventional cities but were privatized a large share of their infrastructure and public goods, public spaces, or they may have been built privately, run privately, designed privately, but they stand, they are part of a country, a bigger country. Or there are cities like our famous Zetes in Honduras, which are as close to pure public city, private cities as we can currently imagine.
So, I've got a load of questions already. Firstly, your theory of cities as firms. Did you already know about free private cities before that? Or was that something you came up with and then realized that some other people were thinking about it as well?
This is something I discovered when I already started my PhD, but pretty early in my way. So Titus Gebel was one of the first people I interviewed throughout my research.
But what about the original idea? As did that just spring out of your experiences? You were a politician in Russia, right?
That's right.
Is that where the idea sprung from?
Yes and no. So again, what you define as an original idea of a private city, because private cities have existed for almost as long as the human civilization have existed. There were this, whatever we define as private. So privately run cities, privately designed cities. You can look, if you look through the history, you see examples everywhere and in every epoch. So trying to remember when I first heard about the Honduran experiment. I think it was pretty long ago. So, okay, since you asked about my experience as a politician, so at first I truly believed that existing cities can be fixed to a point that they again become the hubs of innovation. Well, they are the hubs of innovation. It's not like I'm completely dismissing this. I love big cities. They are the epicenters of innovation and growth and economic prosperity. But it's just that even the best of them are not living up to their potential. But at first, when I was a local councillor in Moscow and I looked at all of that, I thought that was probably the legacy of the Soviet command and control system, all these inefficiencies and all these disappointing things that I came across. Then I started studying cities elsewhere, meeting people who were elected officials elsewhere and also would share my pro-liberty views. And I realized, oh my God, this is not just the Soviet Union legacy. It's not, yeah, it's not the communist aftermath. It's actually the way that it's in all these things like the NIMBYism I mentioned, like the housing crisis where regulations don't allow the supply of houses catch up with the demand and the prices are growing, like in London and, well, most of the big cities. All of this is global. So can there be any alternative paradigm? Can there be a way of create this a new way of running a city? And then I started reading about it, and then I came across the Honduran projects, and then I came across the American privately built cities of the 19th and the 20th century, which are, yes.
What are they? I've never heard of those before, have I? The US built private cities?
Yes, of course. Yeah, and quite a lot. But these are, we are talking about two different eras, I would say. So 19th century, we are talking more about company towns, like Henry Ford would be big on that. And there are still towns that, like the Hershey town that was built by the candy producing company. The Disney cities, there is a celebration in Florida. There are cities. So no, now as I said, one thing is this company towns, which were built in a different political economic paradigm when it was actually, it made economic sense to place your production all in the same place so that people who work on your factory or an oil mine, coal mine or an oil field, they would live close and close to the means of production. And people were basically treated economically, not in the way they were treated bad. Actually, they were treated, many of them, they thought they have, won the lottery by being employed and living in these cities because they, the developer, who is also the owner of a factory or whatever company we're talking about, would provide them with a level of public goods that they rarely could get outside. But in economic terms, they were treated as means of production. So they were not clients. And fast forward into the 20th century, if we talk about private cities like Celebration in Florida, like Irvine in California, residents were treated as end clients. So the city was a product. The city was not a means of production and input. When the car is a product and everything you build in order to maximize the efficiency of producing cars. But when you build cities that are run as large homeownership associations, then people are the end clients and you do everything so that they want to move there.
In, say, the Hershey's city and the Disney city, was there any autonomy? And also in the other ones you mentioned, Irvine and Celebration, was there any autonomy in any of these places? Or were they just private developments?
Well, again, define autonomy. No, not in a modern sense as we talk when we talk about free cities. But it was the autonomy of the developer. And the developer was, it was in the developer's best interests to create a city where the residents would probably have a say, but there wouldn't be very sophisticated democratic procedures. And sometimes it would end up with things that were ridiculed by urban planners, like, for example, celebration where Disney would tell people which color to paint their front doors because everything must comply to the design code, which ultimately is good for the residents as well because people want to live in a nicely looking area and their real estate grows up, their prices grow up, the value grows up. So it's all very much, you can describe it in terms of this market dynamics. Irvine is an interesting case because when it was built in the 70s, completely privately, actually now it's a city with 300,000 people. So it's not small. And it was built privately and designed privately. They got the University of California on board, who provided the first, like they attracted the first tenants. So the original population was very academic-minded, intellectual, global-minded, liberal, and eventually they would want to have a say in the city affairs. So the Irvine company that designed it, they had 100% control over the city, but they decided voluntarily to introduce a local council because that was the organic demand. That's what people wanted. They still kept control over the most of the land and most of the real estate, but everyone ended up a winner.
There, Irvine, there was no wall around it or anything like that. Was there any fence or anything? It was purely...
No, it was purely private.
But other than...
Purely the open, I mean. Yeah.
But other than the fact it was built by a private developer, mm-hmm. So you could, they could stop people going on there, it's like as private property, is that right?
No, not in America.
Right, okay.
Well,
I'm trying to work out what it means to be built by a private entity. Like, what are the benefits other than... Because presumably they still have to follow the rules of the federal rules or the state rules of, say, zoning or I don't know. What kind of autonomy did they have at Irvine?
Again, it depends on the state in America. Some states allow for... So, for example, if we go to the other coast, the celebration in Florida, they had this creek improvement district status, which, well, I don't want to overload you with the details, but this is basically some sort of autonomy. So they were exempt from some regulations, and they had a bit more, the Disney, the developer, a little bit more freedom in exercising their design code, the planning, and all this, everything that relates to governance. But I'm saying it was because, sadly, last year, or was it 2 years ago, the status was revoked. And it was after decades of functioning and bringing fruits and bringing real estate investment there. It basically fell a victim to culture wars because Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, got into conflicts into a conflict with a Disney corporation over the culture war stuff, and the city fell victim to it. I don't know what has changed there since then, if ever anything, but it proves the point that unfortunately, you know, this anti-development ideology, it's not left or right. So we see a lot of NIMBYs with left-wing views who are blocking these projects, like the Google City in Toronto. But we see Ron DeSantis who is using the right-wing ideology to also limit, exercise his power over freedom. So I would say this, as I like to say that this, you know, anti-development stance, it's mainly due to what's called the precautionary principle, basically the fear of everything new all new technologies, new ideas, new paradigms, new ways of doing things, and it's not ideological. So the left can ban, can stop you from innovating because of like under the slogans of inequality and I don't know what else, and the right can say that it's infringing on traditional values or anything like that, but the result is always the same. You have less innovation that you would have otherwise if everybody minded their own business.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because we're in Dubai now. We're making a film about, you know, amongst other things, the UAE's ideas around development. And something that's come up quite a lot in my conversations when I've been interviewing people is, and a lot of people don't actually like to even speak to it too much, is the idea that democratic systems like in the US don't necessarily favor the idea of autonomous cities, certainly not in the long run anyway. Because you can flip-flop every 4 years between policies, between leaders, between... Whereas here in the UAE, obviously, you have emirates here that are essentially run by families and royal families who've been, you know, in power for some time and who have a much of a long-term strategy. What do you think about that idea? Because democracy is one of those things that It's almost certainly in the West, it's untouchable. It's heresy to even question it sometimes. Am I right?
It's a very, very good question. So, yes, here in the Middle East, where we are now, it's in Europe, in the Western democratic countries, it's notoriously difficult to build anything. So I've worked in architecture for past 6-7 years, and I know that it sometimes takes less time and effort and money to build a whole new city from scratch somewhere here in the Arabian desert than to get a permission to improve your own house in London. And this is obviously a big problem, if not a tragedy, for the cities like London. But it's an opportunity for cities like Dubai. If we talk about democracy, I wouldn't treat it as a sacred cow. I would treat it as a tool. So democracy works, can work good on a local level. And the more local it is, the more efficient it is as a tool. And as I say, people want to have a say on about their surrounding. Or they may not want to. So you can have city, ideally, if we talk about private cities, the ideal way would be to have cities that are more democratic, cities that are less democratic, where residents care more, want to vote on things from what color they will paint their front doors to who will be deciding where the budget will be directed towards, what's going to be built and where. And some cities, people just don't want to do it. So they are happy to outsource this decision making to the developer or whatever whatever company was hired to, the management company was hired. So even if we take the Honduran ZS, the charter cities, there are two of them currently that are going forward and under development, and that we're all following closely, Morazan and Prospera. And they are using the same framework legislation, the ZE, but they are quite different internally. So they are targeting different population, blue-collar workers in the case of Morazan, and a more diverse audience, from digital nomads to construction workers in the case of Prospera. They're using different marketing strategies, and Prospera has this very sophisticated legal code that would introduce democracy in a staged way with the growth of the city population. Morazan is more of a it's more of a classic private city in this sense, and we cannot say which one is better. They probably know better because, again, different people want different things. But we'll see what works more efficiently in terms of bringing profit to the developer in maybe 10 years, maybe 20 years. It's important to try out different ways, more democratic and less democratic systems, and just see what we need to have a competition to see what works best.
Do you think the problem with the democratic system is a problem of scale? Do you think there's a limit to which you can scale the democratic process?
It is in many ways the problem of scale. It's not the only problem. If, if you look at the level of corruption, so some systems can work, democratic systems can work better on bigger scale if they have found ways to curb corruption. Some systems collapse even at a smaller scale. If you have lower levels of social capital and trust, and people are more eager to betray each other and to not cooperate. So it has many, many, many aspects to that, but scale is probably the most important.
Can you describe, while we're on the subject of politics and democracy, what was your political situation in Russia when you were a politician yourself? What party were you, and who were you up against?
I was the first member of the Russian Libertarian Party ever elected. So although this party was never officially registered, because we're talking about Russia where no actual real opposition party could be can be registered, but we still considered ourselves a party at some point before the total crackdown on Russian opposition in the past few years. It was one of the largest political opposition powers in Russia. But if we're talking about my experience, it was over 10 years ago. So I was an undergrad student. I was just 20 years old. I was a blogger. I had my Twitter account and a Facebook account. And basically that was it. And I had a bunch of friends who were also very devoted to the same ideas. I didn't have any big political force behind me, or big money, sponsors, big media. It was all a pretty much grassroots campaign. And it was a very exciting experience. Imagine when you're 20 and you get elected, you openly call yourself a libertarian. So suddenly the word libertarian starts appearing in the headlines and people start Googling what it is.
So, I mean, what position, where were you elected? What was the, at what level and in what place?
It was a municipal council in Moscow. It's not the whole of Moscow. It's rather like a borough in London, a district. And so I represented a constituency of roughly 100,000 people, which is still larger than many towns out there.
So who were you up against then in that election?
So most of my competitors, they were people who worked on, as we call them, budgetniki, people who are getting their on a payroll from the government. So they are teachers or doctors or people working on state-run factories. So they are completely dependent from the government, and they would vote whatever the Moscow mayor's office would want them, however they want them to vote. There were a few. So it was a very special time because it was 2011, 2012, and we had parliament elections were rigged, and suddenly there was a big popular uprising. People took to the streets in hundreds of thousands demanding the cancellation of the results, another election, registration of opposition parties, release of political prisoners, and freedom of speech, all the things that we take for granted in the West. And there was a new wave of young political activists, including myself, who discovered ourselves on the, you know, front line of this movement. And I remember me and my friends from the Libertarian Party, we were meeting literally in a basement in central Moscow, and we gathered to discuss it all, and somebody, and we came to the conclusion that, yeah, we cannot lose this chance to, even if we don't win anything, we can talk about libertarian ideas. And they say someone needs to run for local elections, which would be in 2 months from then. And everyone looked at me and said, oh, Vera, she had 30,000 followers on Twitter. That would be her. And I was like, yeah, okay. I guess I've no choice here. Because as every libertarian, I was never hungry for power. It was, yeah, I wanted to show my colleagues, I wanted to show the rest of the free-thinking people that even in a country as unfree as Russia, you can get elected on the platform of liberty if you, you know, find the right words and explain to the people on the street, people next door, that minimal government and maximum freedom will get make their lives better on a daily basis.
So obviously it begs the question then, how much did you win by, and what resulted from that? I mean, what policies were you running on? How much did you win by? What policies were you running on, and what happened once you got into the position?
I don't remember the exact numbers. I think it was something, I won something like 2,000 votes. But the funny thing is that I overran the incumbent head of the council. So suddenly that was, who had been head of the constituency for like a decade. And suddenly I kicked him out of the council. That was funny because I still remembered when I was a school kid, he would sign the this official letters to us, like, congratulations, you're now a school, like, you're starting your school, your school years. So, and then suddenly I'm up against him, and he loses the job. And what happened? What was I running on? So I was talking, so I think the main thing I was talking was transparency and accountability. So this is something that is both in line with the libertarian ideas, but also doesn't require you to talk Mises and Hayek and Rothbard to your potential voters, because, well, this is not something that gets you elected, not at least in, if you're Javier Milei, it probably does, and this is a great thing, but not in the outskirts of Moscow. So, I was talking about putting the local spending under control, that I will do this control where the tax money goes to on their behalf, that I will bring more light into the way that the local government is run, because most people wouldn't know what a municipal council even does. So I remember when I was campaigning and people would come up to me and give me all sort of advice. I was asking, what do you want me to fix? And they said, the Russian space problem is really collapsing. We need to revive it. Something like that. So people wouldn't know that there are different levels of... And it's not... I think it's fairly global problem, because when I then moved to London, I saw that most people didn't care about local elections either. So it's not even because they don't have much power in authoritarian countries like Russia over what the government is doing. It's just this what Brian Kaplan calls rational ignorance, because it's rationally to not put effort into learning all these things that you have so little control over.
And so how did it end? Well, you mentioned just then you ended up in London.
Well, I ended up first with me moving to Ukraine. So, 2014, well, we all know that now there is a war between Russia and Ukraine, but as not that many people know outside of Europe that the war started back in 2014 with the Russia invading annexing Crimea and invading eastern Ukraine. And I'm half Ukrainian. My father grew up there. My mother also has Ukrainian roots. So I had spent a lot of time there as a child. And when the 2014 the Ukrainian revolution started, I went there to Kyiv to have a first-hand experience of that. And I was impressed by how much different the Ukrainian mentality was, in a way that people were much more skeptical of the government and much more eager to self-organize. And well, it's a very long story. It's not my own theory, but I have an explanation why it's so. That partially it's history, partially it's recent history, partially it's the more distant history. But bottom line is that I was impressed, and then the liberal forces, the democratic forces, won in Ukraine, and simultaneously in Russia there was a new wave of repression, and I was still running. I tried to run for a higher office that summer, but the atmosphere was entirely different. People would consider us national traitors. That was Putin's expression towards everyone who didn't support his policies. And I remember, I faced censorship on a few occasions. So, you know, Russia supported this separatist movements in eastern Ukraine, and I wrote an article interviewing people from Siberia who were mockingly saying that we want independence, more independent on Siberia, because if federalization, as it was called by the Russian propaganda, is a good thing, then we want to federalize Siberia. We have all the oil. You're just pumping it from us, and we're left with nothing. I published that interview, and the next week we had a warning from the Russian censorship agency that they would close our media if we do that again. So there was there were several events that made me more consider moving to Kyiv instead, because there was a window of opportunity. And then I got an invitation from Atlas Network, a libertarian think tank, to work for a new think tank in Kyiv that would promote economic freedom in the post-revolutionary Ukraine. And so that was the next chapter of my story.
Right. I've got too many questions already. Just out of interest, because you were an elected libertarian politician, what do you think of Milei? Have you followed that closely? What's going on in Argentina now?
I was following it probably not as close as many of our listeners, but I think it is a promising development. It would be, well, first of all, it is really hard to mess up Argentina further than it has already messed up. So this is good news for Milei, and this is hope for that if he at least marginally improves the situation, there would be a win for the libertarian ideas. It would be very sad if, because he wouldn't be as agile, or because the system would be too resistant, he will not be able to deliver on his promises. And then everyone will point to this case and say, oh, see, here's what libertarians are. They promise you this, this, and this, and then nothing happens, or things get worse. So he's it's the first person that gets elected president as an, you know, unapologetically anarcho-capitalist politician, libertarian politician. So the stakes are really high, because in all the past cases, like, for example, if we take Chile during Pinochet, Well, he had a team of economists, Chicago economists, who were the heroes of free market thinking, but it was not a libertarian government, and he definitely was not a libertarian president. So, yeah, people like to point out to this and see, yeah, you guys are not as good as you think. But here, if we take Milei, he says, I'm a libertarian, so everything he does will be judged through this lens. So we'll just have to wish him best of luck.
Is it a bit of an oxymoron, a libertarian leader? You alluded to this yourself earlier when you amongst your friends, you were trying to decide who should be put up to...
And nobody wanted to do
that.
Well,
of course, but I understand that. And presumably you do too, that as someone who might be sympathetic to libertarian ideas, you don't really want to tell anyone else what to do. It's part of the kind of, you know, it's part of the sentiment that's embedded within it. Is that right, according to you? I mean, what do you think?
This is right, yes. And a libertarian politician, well, it may be an oxymoron. You know, as they say, yeah, libertarians are this dangerous conspiracy who want to take the power over and leave everyone alone. So ultimately, yes. But as I think you said during our previous conversations, that nobody will vote for the guy who says, vote for me, I will do nothing for you. Yeah, I really love this this joke. So we still, I don't want to say that meme phrase, we live in a society, but we live in a society and we live in a political system that involves violence, that involves control over other people's money. So I won't say the only way to change it to the better is trying to take over the control and gradually give it back to the people. It's not the only way. That's why we're sitting here, because I believe in creating and you believe in creating parallel structures. But this is one of the ways, because, yeah, there are different countries, different parts of the world, we deal with different political, economic systems, and some of them, like Argentina in 2023, allow people with that kind of ideas that we cherish to win the popular vote, but many do not. Probably the majority do not in democratic countries, because people like free stuff. They like when they are promised free stuff. In autocratic countries like Russia, well, that's obvious. It doesn't mean that running for office as a free marketeer, as a anarcho-capitalist or minarchist or classical liberal or whatever you call yourself, but I know this, if you believe in the ideas of freedom, is a no-go. But just I decided for myself that I want to try to take a different path.
Something else I often end up speaking with people about is how many people actually want freedom in their life. And I think one of the traps that a number of people I know fall into is wanting to give everyone freedom or wanting to inspire freedom in everyone. But I think the truth is probably, and it's probably quite a small percentage of people that actually genuinely care about freedom, because it's quite a lot of effort to actually assert freedom, if you see what I mean. And a much easier option that most people are quite comfortable with is to let some people get away with telling them what to do to a point, and they don't really mind. So my question would then be, as a libertarian, say, which you obviously are, where would you decide to go and live? Like, what's the place where, do you want to be amongst a bunch of libertarians? Do you want to run off to the Free State Project and live amongst your people, or are you happy in a society of individuals? You know, what's the best solution according to you for libertarians, people that want liberty?
It is funny that you mentioned the Free State Project in New Hampshire, because that's exactly where I almost ran back in 2014 when I was realizing that things in Russia are getting greatly bad. And if I stayed, probably wouldn't end well, good for me. And there was, and before I had that opportunity to go to Kiev and work to promote on promoting freedom in Ukraine, I spent a few months in Free State Project in New Hampshire, and it was a fascinating experience, and I'd say it added significantly to me believing in the idea of this intentional communities. But I still don't think I would live there. I'm just a big fan of large cities. So, well, it's a fascinating experience, because you see that people are not, they were not challenging the existing system. They were, again, trying to create a pocket of freedom within that system. And it actually worked, because it wasn't, you know, from outside it may seem almost like a cult. You know, people are so, well, not to us, but to somebody who, you know, the way it's vilified and portrayed in the American media, people running from everywhere, they and create this, well, you know what I mean. Yeah. So, but it was a very nice experience. It was not, so people were just living their lives, but, you know, doing whatever they wanted, they felt like, they enjoyed, to just, you know, a little bit of advancing freedom on a daily basis. Somebody would teach in local universities, somebody would run, like you do, a radio podcast, someone would organize festivals and camping sites and or Bitcoin conferences, or even dancing clubs. Someone would run for local office. So it was one of the ways to go for me. But as I said, people, back to your original question, do people like freedom? Well, generally, yes, but they also like other things. They like security, they like convenience, they like excitement and having a lot of amenities around. So, and they base, they decide where to live based on all of these things combined. So if you're running from a place that's, you know, a country that's at war, or a country that's very poor and or unsafe, then probably the freedom and you know, autonomy comes first for you, and you will move no matter where. You will take a boat and risk your life to travel to a place that's safer. But if you already live happily and conveniently in a city that is like London or New York, in a city that is nice, that has all kind of culture and people and all this diversity, and you're already used to it, you have your favorite coffee shop, you have your favorite organic grocery store, but you're constantly, you know, gradually less and less happy about the price of that you pay for rent, or the way that transport is mismanaged or things like that, then you might be thinking from time to time, oh, should I move somewhere? But it will take more for your potential city of destination to lure you in than just give you a tax break.
Aren't there any big cities in New Hampshire then?
The biggest city is Manchester. It's not very big. I don't remember the numbers, but...
Not big enough for you?
No.
What about this then? Because this is something I've observed about cities, that within cities, your governability goes up, let's say. You know, And that's why I chose to live in the middle of nowhere, really. Because I really do like to be left alone. I'm not super subversive necessarily. I just like to be left alone. So isn't there a bit of a dichotomy? Is that the right word? That you're attracted to cities, but probably cities offer you the least amount of freedom, would you say?
No, I don't think cities offer you the least amount of freedom. Again, cities are... In a city, you're basically surrounded by a lot of strangers, people minding their own business. If you take a rural place, if you take a village, I would say there would be more... You are more likely to encounter a collectivist mentality, a more traditionalist mentality where people want everyone to comply with some rules, unspoken and written rules. So a lot of people leave their traditionalist communities and go to cities, and they feel it as a liberation because they can choose whether to, I don't know, wear a headscarf or not, whether to work as a woman or not, whether to marry a person of the same sex or not, something that would be unthinkable back home. So that's one aspect. Another aspect is that cities are the hubs of innovation, of despite all the, you know, regulations that we talked about. You meet people with different perspectives, and what's most important, you meet them, you know, the serendipity. You don't necessarily plan to meet anyone, so you just encounter them by chance. You don't know who you will encounter tomorrow, and from this unexpected encounters, a lot of new ideas get born, a lot of new organizations, associations, friendships, economic enterprises. So, and this all, yeah, this all brings more progress. This all brings more, you know, more freedom in some sense.
I suppose when I was imagining it, as I was saying it, I was thinking more on a physical and in a physical sense, the ability for something oppressive to control your life would seem much, for me, much easier in a city, because you're monitored more in that situation, but by default, but just because of the modern age and technology. And out in the, well, outside of the cities, it is harder to govern. But obviously, yeah, I'm not a city boy. I've lived in London. I did live in London for 8 years, right in the middle of London. But it gives me the shivers to go back there now.
And this is absolutely perfect because, yeah, people should be able to live up to their preferences. And I remember during the pandemic, there was a lot of this whining, oh, the cities will die out. Nobody will want to live in these cramped places anymore. And a lot of people left places like London. I have a lot of friends, well, maybe not a lot, but quite a few friends who left London and moved to the countryside and stayed there when the pandemic was over. And I think it's a great thing because people had... And then, yeah, obviously London didn't die because more people who always wanted to live in a big city but couldn't afford could finally do that because, you know, because other people moved out. So this is a normal market process. We should aspire for the world where people would live where they live, not out of necessity because they need to go to the office every day, but because they enjoy it. People who love countryside would live in the countryside and do everything they need to do work-wise, study-wise, social-wise from there. People who enjoy living in the buzz of a big city would do that again, not because they have to go to the office, but just because they like all the neon signs and the pubs and all this concentration of galleries and theaters and whatever the city, big cities are famous for.
I think in my case, It was, I had stages in my life. When I was younger, cities seemed like a great idea. And probably if there were cities that were more conducive to the kind of lifestyle I'm looking for, that may have endured into my later life. But I find the idea of bringing up children in London a terrible idea, a really terrible idea. So, which leads me on to a question for you. Do free cities have to be a city?
Not necessarily. So we use it as an umbrella term for the lack of, you know, another umbrella term. But yeah, you know, actually there is no clear definition of a city. And in my dissertation, I dedicate, you know, a large part of it, of an intro chapter to just defining what a city is, because there are some exotic definitions like a city. Do you know what a city, what's the difference between a city and a town historically?
Well, in the UK, it's whether it has a cathedral.
Right. Yeah. So obviously this is not what we are thinking about when we're building a free city. And again, if you look at, for example, in Denmark, benchmark for how big a population of a settlement should be to be considered a city is like times and times smaller than in China. So population is also not a...
factor.
Not a factor, yes. So the definition of, I think, is it the United Nations? So some official definition says that a city is a settlement where most people are not engaged in agricultural work. So this is, I think, more, that better describes what we think of when we think of cities. But yeah, it definitely doesn't have to. So again, Prospera is not looking at like a city now, probably will not, because yeah, it benefits from the seacoast, and you can have a like you live on the seacoast surrounded by the palms. So probably people wouldn't want to a bunch of skyscrapers there, or probably they would. We'll see. And so currently there is, if you look at what the market wants, what the residents want, they want places that are walkable, they want low-rise or mid-rise buildings, they want a lot of greenery. You see a lot of these pockets in Dubai, which is built in the desert, but the developers go an extra mile or extra 100 miles to bring water and greenery and wildlife to this pockets oasis where people live. If we talk about again another example that I like, the city of Lavasa in India near Mumbai, it was advertised as the most walkable city in India, and it is. And I interviewed people who moved there, Indians who had left India years ago, because you know India, if you take 100 most polluted cities in the world, 83 would be in India. So, and then suddenly you build something like that, which is unseen in a country like India. You build a city which is in serene environment with Mediterranean architecture, with lakes. And people who had left the country a long time ago, they see it in the news and they're like, oh, I as a retired person, I want to spend... my later years, I want to spend them back home, and they go there.
Interestingly, you mentioned, was it the UN that said cities are places without much agricultural work?
Yeah, where the majority of residents are not involved in agriculture.
A few days ago, we visited an urban farm in Masdar City here in Dubai, which is they call them vertical farms.
Right.
So they may have to change that definition, because they're specifically targeting urban farmers. It's quite astonishing, actually. They're basically containers. The ones they ship things across the world in, those kind of containers. I think they're 40-foot containers. And on either side, inside, are just rows and rows of, I mean, they're growing salad at the moment. And you use an app to grow it, and you control everything. The lady told us that you need about 15 minutes a day of actual labour to grow 4 tons of greenery in one of these containers each year. So yeah, so it may be that the cities of the future are agricultural places after all. I've got a few more questions about architecture, because you've been working in the architecture field.
True.
I don't know how much you can talk about this, because I often find whenever I start mentioning things like this, I get people saying, "Oh, I've signed an NDA, I've done this, I've done that." But we hear a lot here in Dubai about Saudi Arabia, and I've seen some incredible plans, obviously, of what's happening there. It's obviously very relevant to the Free Cities ecosystem as well, because it does appear that they might be creating some kind of
autonomy.
Yeah, I mean, some kind of dual, you know, there'll be Saudi, old Saudi and new Saudi coexisting together. I don't know. What can you tell us from your experience of, because I know you have worked in that part of the world, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So I work for Zaha Hadid Architects, and the last year our largest growth was in the Middle East. I think it was 3 times our business has grown 3 times in the Middle East. And it's not just us, so all the big and probably even not so big architecture firms are now working a lot here, because as I said, it's easier to build a city there than one small building somewhere in the European Union. And it's funny that you mentioned the Saudi Arabia. I remember, and Masdar before that. Masdar was one of my case studies for my PhD. And originally it was supposed to be NEOM, which I approved with my supervisor. But a few months before I already had to hand in my work, I realized that NEOM hadn't built anything in this 4 years that I was writing. So I replaced it with Masdar. So yeah, things like this, they take ages. And I would say the main criteria, well, again, we cannot talk about whether it will work out or not, but the main criteria is whether it has an economic backing and not just whether it's just if we talk about these new cities, especially cities built top down, whether it's just a PR thing, it's a vanity thing, or it has some economic meaning behind it. Again, Dubai is a good example, because there is this famous Palm Island, an island in the shape of a palm, and a lot of people ridicule it and say it was an unnecessary extravagance. But if you look at it, it actually makes economic sense, because people want to live in the seafront. And what do you do to get more real estate investment? You artificially multiply the seafront. So every leaf of this palm is a artificially created seafront, and the real estate, the influx on investment in real estate was massive. They sold the buildings in 3 days before anything was built, when it was still open sea. So whether you like it architecturally or not, it's a genius decision from the economic point of view. And a lot of people want to emulate, a lot of rulers all across the Middle East want to emulate Dubai's success. But Dubai's success was not because, it was not because Dubai stands in some particular a convenient place. Actually, the opposite. It's the least... it's the worst place you can think of to build a city. It was a scorching sun, the desert, no tourist attractions. It was one of the few places in the Middle East where there are no historical sites. Oil only 4% of all the Emirati oil. Many people think Dubai was built on oil. It's not the case. It was due to the fact that the rulers were thinking as entrepreneurs. So yes, it was a lot of, maybe not all, but the major, you know, things that we perceive as vanity projects, they were built with profit in mind. And whether the Saudi government thinks as an entrepreneur, whether, you know, Qatar also did a lot of this, especially before the World Cup. So yeah, that's an open question.
I've got one last question, because I know you've got to go, unfortunately. Like I say, I think we should continue this some other time. I don't know whether I'll see you again, but you've got to go to an Austrian economics meeting, haven't you? With regards to Noam and the line in particular, the line is the one that mystifies me, because I've seen lots of the other plans and they're very majestic and they're very beautiful. And I can, but the line doesn't seem to make much sense from a planning perspective to me, other than this. See what you think about this. So the line is 200 meters wide, okay? 200 kilometers long, is that right? Or potentially, it's going to be very long, but it's only 200 meters wide. And if you put buildings 50 meters either side, that means 100 meters between the buildings. Personally, I don't think that would be very conducive to living.
Me neither.
Right, okay. But what about this? Because I've been asking everyone this. Number one is, I don't think the Saudi, the people backing this project, they're not stupid. They've got a lot of money. There's obviously a reason to do this thing. But it did occur to me that when Dubai was first built, this road down there behind us probably looked like a very long line when it was first built, because Dubai was, a lot of it was based around a large avenue, wasn't it? Might that be?
It is still a very stretched out city, and I can tell you that it creates a lot of inconveniences, because the Sheikh Zayed Road, which is the main avenue, not just for Dubai but for the whole country, which connects Dubai to other Emirates as well, it gets completely jammed during rush hours.
So lines are not a good planning policy.
It depends, because now we are mostly using cars to drive around to get from point A to point A to point B. We don't know what it will be in 10 years. So again, Masdar wanted to create this. So when they were conceived back in, I think, 2005, they were envisioning this light rail or something like that. So something that became completely obsolete. The rationale was sustainability. They wanted to make clean transport, green transport. It became completely obsolete with the rise of the electric cars. So if you plan for a particular if you plan a city with a particular mode of transport in mind, it might, by the time you build it, because building a city is takes a very long time. It's a huge endeavor. Then probably will be obsolete by the time your city becomes livable. So
we don't see many examples in history of cities evolving along a line, do we?
Well, we know cities that were that grew, well, mainly it's like the case of Dubai, when it's built along this, the seacoast. But in most cases, these cities, they are suffering from congestion.
So what do you think? Do you think the line might start as a line and then turn into a sphere?
We shall see. So as far as I know, the line is built with walkability in mind and non-motorized ways of modes of transport. So probably they are thinking that congestion will not be a problem.
Just quickly then, what about the idea that there may be private governance in Saudi? Do you think that's a possibility?
I think it's quite far from, you know, talking about private governance. But when I talk to people in this, broadly speaking, free cities movement, I know that many of them are looking with curiosity at the Middle East in general, because for the reasons that here you have lower transaction costs related to, well, I know that's an academic way to say there's no democracy here. So nobody will, there's no NIMBYs to stop your development. And if you happen to pitch your project, then things can go pretty smoothly, as it was in the case of Masdar, which was, it was a project by the Abu Dhabi Sheikh, but it had a lot. They got a lot of private companies on board, so it was a semi-privately built city. But this creates a transaction cost of another, not necessarily transaction costs, but it doesn't necessarily mean stability. So again, speaking of Saudi, Jeddah, the city of Jeddah in Saudi planned to build, years ago, they tried to build a tower that would replace Burj Khalifa as the world's tallest building. And because the developer who was building it got out of favor with the ruler, it stands half built in the middle of the desert as a testament, as a reminder that even in non-democratic countries, the absence of, you know, these democratic hurdles doesn't mean complete stability.
Right. I think we may have to leave it there, Vera, unfortunately, because I know you've got a meeting to go to. But thanks for talking. And I would love to carry on at a later date, because I've got a whole page full of questions here that I haven't been able to ask. But thanks very much for talking. And yeah, see you next time.
Thank you, Tim.